Good morning, we'll get started. Thanks for coming. This is our September back-to-school version of the school buses running through my neighborhood now. It's like, God, where did the summer go? We are really pleased to have this great panel on legal writing, which we can all, you know, even somebody who's been doing it as long as I have, really appreciates the tips and the ideas and something fresh about how to improve how you're communicating with the court, with your clients. It's important, definitely. We've got an all-star panel for you. We've got Stephanie Webb, who's Judge Helfinger's law clerk. We've got Laura Steele, who is my former law clerk, and now she's at Kirkman & Dunn, and has a lot of journalism kind of experience in the background, so that's what gets her here. And we're very pleased to welcome Lisa Mazey from Marquette Law School. So she's teaching the young people, and now she's going to help some of us who are not so young with some of these tips. I really appreciate you all coming. Next month on, October 14th, we have a Basics for the Pro Se Help Desk, and people who help pro bono type, pro se type clients. And this is going to be co-sponsored with the
Eastern District.
The Eastern District Bar Association, thank you, Laura. And as a special treat, there will actually be breakfast at the Lou Jones Breakfast. Thank you to the Eastern District. This was somebody's biggest disappointment, that there was no breakfast at the Lou Jones Breakfast. But next month there will be breakfast. So even if you don't go near the Pro Se Help Desk, and I want to ask you why you don't, but even if you don't, please come have some breakfast and listen to some ideas for how to deal with pro ses and help in pro bono. In November, we're going to have our annual program, Supreme Court Year in Review. And of course, we had some big Supreme Court decisions this year, and a preview for what's coming next year. That's going to be the third Tuesday in November. And finally, in December, Jack's Ethics, what are we going to do? Jack is in Chicago, so we're looking for, you know, and of course the ethics there are questionable, so we're having Jack back. I'm sure he's fallen under the influence, but seriously, we are going to tell you who the panel is going to be a little bit later. So, again, today we've got legal writing, next month, pro bono, pro se, then the Supreme Court, and then ethics. So please keep coming to the Lou Jones Breakfast. Thank you so much. And to our panel.
Okay, thank you, Judge Kelly. I'm going to start off, as Judge Kelly said, I'm Stephanie Webb. I'm Judge Helfinger's law clerk, and before that I was Judge Shapiro's law clerk. So I've spent the last 5+ years reading all the writing that you guys have submitted, so I thank you for that. And you know, writing really is the way that you all are able to communicate with the court. So hopefully I'm able to give a little bit of insight into what the court, what the judges, and the law clerks are looking for in your writing in order to make it the most effective and get you the relief that you want. So starting point is the motion. You file a motion. In my opinion, a motion really has three goals. That is to explain to the court what it is, what relief it is that your client wants. The second is why your client is entitled to that relief. The third, that is the most difficult and the one that we most often see left out, is what authority the court has to grant you the relief that you want. So bankruptcy is statutory based. We're working in the bankruptcy code. So you want to cite the bankruptcy code section on which you rely. The first example that I give is, I think we see these a lot around here, a motion to retain a tax refund. So what relief does your client want? They want to keep their tax refund. Why are they entitled to that? Maybe they had some unexpected expense that they need to pay for, or something that they need to purchase that was not in their budget. And then the third one is the basis for the court's authority. Why can the court grant you a motion to retain your tax refund? As far as I know, there's no provision in the code that speaks to either turnover or retention of the tax refund. What requires you to turn over the tax refund is the order confirming the plan. You put in the plan that you're going to remit one half of your refunds to the trustee. So what you're looking for is relief from that order confirming the plan with the requirement that you turn over the tax refunds. So I posit the question, is this really better couched as a 1329 motion to modify the confirmed plan? So just keep that in mind and tell the court what statutory basis they have for granting the relief you want. And then once you've found the code section that applies, you want to allege all the statutory elements. Avoid doing so in the alternative unless you can show that both alternatives are satisfied. So your client is in a Chapter 7 case. He has some collateral he wants to retain. You're going to file a motion to redeem. Maybe the value is less than the lien, so you're going to file a 722 motion to redeem. And you say to the court the property is either exempt or abandoned. Most Chapter 7 cases are no asset cases in this district. So even if there's a no asset report, the property is typically not abandoned until the case is closed. I doubt you're filing the motion to retain or the motion to redeem after the case is closed. So you're probably going to have to rely on the provision providing for the property is exempt. So allege that it's exempt and then make sure that it is actually exempt. Check your Schedule C and make sure that you know what you're alleging to the court is actually backed up by your schedules. The corollary to the code and the statute is the rules. The rules are just as long as the code. There's a lot of them, and they provide a lot of different standards. So I'll just go over a couple of them. Rule 1007C, for example, the court may, for cause shown, grant an extension of time to file schedules. So you don't get your schedules filed within 14 days. Maybe your client couldn't come in and sign all the schedules that you need to file. That's no problem. You can move the court for an extension of time to do so, but you do need to show cause to get that motion granted. Compare that, though, with Rule 4008A. The court may, at any time in its discretion, enlarge the time to file a reaffirmation agreement. So you get to 60 days from the first date set for meeting of creditors, and ABC Bank hasn't returned your reaff to you, and you need to move the court to extend the time to do so. You can do that, and you don't have to show cause. If you allow the time period to lapse, you now have to show excusable neglect under 9006B1. Give a look at 9006B2 and B3. There are certain periods that the court is not permitted to enlarge or that are governed by a different rule. Those are set forth in B3. And then finally, be mindful of specific limitations. For example, in Rule 4004C2, a court may defer entry of discharge for 30 days, and then on motion within that time, defer entry of discharge to a date certain. So if you need 60 days, if you need to defer your client's discharge for 60 days, you can't move the court the first time to extend it for 60 days. You move the court to extend for 30 days and then file another motion within that time to extend to an additional 30 days, so you get your 60 days total. So you filed your motion, and when you know you get an objection, and now you're before the court on a contested matter and the court calls for briefs. There's just a couple of things I wanted to point out on brief writing. We see less briefs than obviously we do motions and orders, but be mindful of the order of authorities when you're citing cases to the court. The Supreme Court decided in 91 that preponderance of the evidence is the standard for a dischargeability action. So if you're filing a complaint, I know it's really easy to go on Westlaw and do a quick Google search, standard of proof, and you pull up the first bankruptcy case you see and you kind of throw it in your brief. If there's a Supreme Court decision out there or a Seventh Circuit decision out there, it's really more persuasive to cite those cases rather than a bankruptcy court decision. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about the overall structure of the argument and structure of your brief and how you can make that the most persuasive. I've seen sometimes when I'm reading briefs that practitioners find a case that is supportive of their position, and they sort of model their brief after the structure of that case. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, but bankruptcy court decisions, especially bankruptcy judges, are going to rely on different code sections, different rules, different policy arguments, perhaps legislative history, and they're going to pick the sections in the rules that they think are most persuasive and that support their argument, and those are what they're going to put in their opinion. Those are what they're going to rely on when they're writing their opinion. So that's great for you to rely on those same arguments, but if your opposing counsel is relying on different code sections and different rules, and those briefs are both structured after the cases in those ways, then when the court goes to read them, there's sometimes a disconnect between the two cases. So make sure that you're structuring your overall argument in the way that you want to present it to the court, and make sure that you're really addressing your opposing counsel's argument. And that goes to the third point. If there's not an on-point decision, again, that's Seventh Circuit Supreme Court, then spend less time explaining the supporting cases. The briefs that I think the court finds the most persuasive are those that not regurgitate the reasoning of other cases, other bankruptcy courts that have decided the issue, but rather structuring, presenting an argument and an analytical framework in which the court can work. So explain to the court, you know, why should the court adopt the reasoning of these cases rather than this case says this and my case is like that. And then finally, a lot of issues in bankruptcy are fact intensive, so make sure, especially if you are the party carrying the burden of proof, that you establish a complete factual record. If you get to the point where you're briefing an issue and perhaps there's a question of whether an expense deduction is reasonable for purposes of projected disposable income, and you file a brief arguing a bigger issue, but you want to say in there that the certain expense deduction is reasonable, that's a fact question. And if there's nothing in the record to support that, it's going to make it difficult for the court to find that you've carried your burden of proof if, for example, where you're before the court on confirmation. And then finally, a little bit about orders. So you've either filed a motion and you didn't get a response, or you got a response, you went before the court on a preliminary hearing or an evidentiary hearing, and you're submitting an order out of the hearing. Omit relief that's not requested in the motion. So the time to think about, you know, what am I going to put in this order? I need to take this order to state court. What is that state court judge going to want to see? Or I need to take this order to a car creditor so that he'll give my client a car loan. What does that car creditor need to see? The time to really think about all that stuff that needs to go in the order is when you're filing the motion. The order should be codifying the relief that was granted in the motion. So don't just throw things in there at the end when you need, when you get your motion and you realize that there's something additional you need. And then, this is kind of picky, but avoid the unnecessary use of Latinisms. My favorite is nunc pro tunc, just because it sounds kind of cool and we see it a lot around here, but correctly used nunc pro tunc is limited to correcting clerical errors made by the court, and we never make those kind of clerical errors, so you shouldn't be putting nunc pro tunc in your orders. And then finally, incorporate the terms of the party stipulation into the orders. It makes it easier for the court and the parties to review. For one, if the court's reviewing an affidavit of default and we're referring back to an order, we want to make sure that if it's an order on stipulation, we can look at the order and see what it is that the court ordered without having to refer to the stipulation that may be, you know, a few docket entries up. And then just as a practical concern, the BNC...
I would just point out that's a point of preference among judges. I do not prefer you to put the terms of your stipulation as my order, because then I find like I'm ordering the... things that are not really orders. They're things that the parties may have agreed to, but they're not really something that I'm ordering. So
yeah,
I would prefer if you want to stipulate to things, that's great, but not that you, and I can't off the top of my head think of an example mm-hmm. of some things that are stipulated to. I mean, clearly.
Well, they may be facts.
Yeah, they're facts.
That they're stipulated.
Yeah, the debtor defaulted prior to the, you know, on the doomsday. Well, I'm not ordering that the debtor defaulted
right. yeah.
on the doomsday order, and so I don't prefer to see. I mean, if you want to put an order that the debtor shall make all the payments from September through February, that's fine. But it gets a little bit iffier when you incorporate some
sure.
other things.
Yeah, this is probably something a matter of people will disagree about, but at least in my mind, the order ought to be a self-contained document. The order really, you know, like the civil procedure rule that talks about the granting of injunctive relief, I think that rule is, which says that the terms of the injunction have to be set out in the order itself. And really, I think that's a fairly good rule for all days. That the order, you ought to be able to read the order and figure out what relief the order grants without, say, going back to the motion. Sometimes proposed orders will say, you know, the motion is granted in all respects. Well, you know, you get that someday down the road, and, you know, partially I know this from doing appellate work, is then what does that mean? Because then you go back and you read the motion, and there's sort of all sorts of things. Is it limited to what the motion requested in the wherefore provision? You know, is what's requested in the wherefore provision informed by what's in the rest of the motion, that the motion was now granted in all respects? you know, I've sort of had to deal with that in the appellant context, and I think it just, you know, it sort of leaves the matter somewhat unclear. And I granted things like facts and stuff, I wouldn't say put in the order. But in terms of what's the actual relief being granted, I think it ought to be in the order. So you don't have to, you know, the order grants the stipulation. Well, then you have to go read the stipulation to figure out what the stipulation means. And it's one thing maybe if it's attached, physically attached to the order. But in some ways, right, the better way is just to have the order say, this is what I'm ordering.
It doesn't bother me.
Another thing about
stipulation, it's your agreement. I mean, I agree with you if it's a, after a contested matter, clearly I'm not just saying, yeah, the court had a trial and granted the complaint. No. But if it's a stipulation between the parties, why is my order required to regurgitate? And some of them are just, they're literally taking the word stipulation off the form and putting order on it and submitting that for me to sign. I'm not comfortable with that.
On a different topic, because brilliant minds disagree, but on a different topic, another thing I see a lot in orders is the court having found, and then a bunch of stuff. That really disturbs me when it's a default motion and I didn't find anything, just nobody showed up to the party, and so I'm signing the order. But even after a hearing, you need to think hard about that, the court having found sentence, because if you didn't hear the words come out of the judge's mouth, or you don't have a finding and conclusion that specifically says it, I've not signed orders when they've said that I found something that I have absolutely no recollection of finding. Now, I don't remember what I had for breakfast this morning either, so I could be wrong, but I'm uncomfortable with somebody telling me I found something that I don't think I found.
Just put yourself in the position of the court, and what do you want the court to do? I'm all the time listening to attorneys say, well, I'm concerned about so-and-so. Don't tell me what you're concerned about. Tell me what you want me to do. And think about that with respect to the order as well. What are you asking the court to do? So if you put yourself in that position, then it's easy to pare it down, easier.
Sure. And I sort of wanted to transition to that, too. I mean, I think in my outline, I have a section on proposed orders. And I think from my experience working behind, you know, closed doors here, you know, it's frustrating for the judge to see typos in an order or things like that. You're asking them to put their signature on your order that you've drafted. And, you know, as an officer of the court, it represents what the court has found. So, you know, I think it goes to all of legal writing where you're writing with a purpose, you're trying to get some action or relief for your client. If the court finds that you're, you know, doing something inaccurate in order, I mean, that doesn't really go to your credibility. So that's obviously something that's really important. But kind of circling back to my sort of segment of this outline, I wanted to talk a little bit about purpose and also sort of presentation in a way too. So first of all, just starting with purpose, we actually do a lot of different kinds of writing in bankruptcy court. We have contract writing, which is in the plan, which is, you know, involves a lot of very precise language, definitions, structure, how a claim's going to be treated, how this thing's going to be effectuated, those are sort of things. And you want to write that like a contract. But we also do other things like a disclosure statement, which is more of a narrative. You want to tell the court how did this debtor get here? They don't know what this company is. They don't know what they do. They don't know the circumstances that led them to get here. And they're interested. I think, you know, people are interested in people's stories, and you want to know what got them here and how they're getting out of the situation and where they're going next. And that's your opportunity in a disclosure statement. So you're not writing it like a contract. You're not, I don't think that, you know, in a contract you're writing these definitions that are very precise and can come back to you and have, you know, meanings that you want to carry through that that document. But in a disclosure statement, you're talking, you know, who this person is and being descriptive. And I don't think you have to be as formal with, you know, the overuse of definitions. I mean, the definition of the is the. You know, I don't think you need to do that everywhere and every single thing you write. And again, for the proposed orders, I mean, you're really trying to summarize what, you know, your, you know, 5-6 page motion is asking for, putting that in bullet points, basically saying the court is blessing this, getting that signed. Again, you know, omitting arcane language, I think sometimes, you know, heretofore or wherefore, things like that are, you know, whereas, you know, the court grants X, you know, will do. I don't think that we need to exercise our knowledge of Latin everywhere. And then for brief writing, which I know Lisa will sort of carry us through more on the structural organization of brief writing, You know, you're really trying to make an argument to the court and trying to convince them that your view of this issue is correct. That you're saying, Judge, you know, here's the law, here are the facts, here's my position, and this is why you should follow it. You know, I think the more you can provide an outline for the court to follow your reasoning step by step with support in the law, that's what you're trying to accomplish in a brief at the end of the day. And then in terms of thinking visually, I found this quote from Judge Posner, who is very kind of prickly a little bit. And I just thought it was interesting that he really emphasized that when you're writing, you want to think about things in a visual manner. And I think that in a lot of what we do, it can be simplified in a way where, you know, things are summarized in a chart or just broken down in a way that is really understandable. I mean, when you're doing an omnibus claim objection and you have 5 or 6 claim objections that you're objecting to, why not just do a chart saying this is the claim amount, this is the disputed amount, and here's the agreed amount or something like that. You know, so I think the more you can use charts and visuals in your motions, I think it helps the court. I think it makes their jobs easier to really understand the information and synthesize it. The other thing, too, to think about is when you attach exhibits to your motions, I think it's, I've seen it in, you know, in court where the judge is trying to find something, you know, where you file the motion and all your exhibits are attached to it. So it's really difficult to go and find, Judge, I'm talking about page 3 of X transcript, you know, well, you know, highlight it. There's PDF, there's a way of, you know, using your PDF, Adobe Acrobat to, you know, really bookmark those things and highlight them for the court. So if you have a transcript and, you know, defendant is saying X and you want to point the judge to that, you know, section when they're reading your brief, you know, highlight it. Go ahead and use, you know, a circle in your Adobe Acrobat or something like that to show exactly where you're going. And I think that just makes the court's job a little bit easier rather than reading through a 50-page transcript. You know, they've got better things to do with their time. So really just thinking, you know, how is this all sort of going to be perceived by the court, and how can I walk them through that in the clearest manner? And in that vein, too, I think the way that you organize your briefs can really kind of create that roadmap for the court and say, you know, here's my introduction, here's my basis, and really use your topics and your organization to have a clean way of walking them through it. So if you're using subheads, you know, be consistent. You don't have to use Roman numerals. Not everything has to be super formal. I mean, you can use different kinds of bold or italics, but as long as you're consistent and simple and clean, I think that really helps the court, and I think it helps organize your own thoughts as well. And I have examples in here just of, you know, some general outlines for a motion to withdraw the reference and then a brief in opposition. And you'll see that it's, you know, the sentences should not be long, they're short. They're saying this is not appropriate or this is appropriate, and here's my argument in a one-sentence summary, basically. And then you're going to walk the court through that in that structure. And then just some other things that I was sort of thinking about as I was thinking about this presentation is, you know, when we cite to the record, I think a lot of times people will say, you know, transcript dated X date 2014, page 6, paragraph, whatever, and it's cumbersome to see. And I think that if you can come up with a simplified way of doing that, say, you know, use R for record. Record, docket number, you know, 30, P6, you know, and I think the court is smart enough where they can follow that, maybe do the first one, a full reference, and then really simplify it. Just because I think when you look at a document and it's got all these citations, I mean, it's ugly. You don't want to read that. And I think it's easier to kind of just walk through a clean document. Again, you know, avoid those large block quotes. They're tempting to just pull in a whole thing, but the court doesn't want to read it. You know, I think it's boring to put a whole thing in there, and if you can't say what it says, then I'm not sure what the point of it would be.
And well, before you move on to that, I just can't resist. One of the favorite things that Judge Easterbrook ever told me, he pretty much writes all his own things, and he would send the clerks the first draft that, quite frankly, most of the time were pretty close to the final draft. And we would write margin comments on it. And, you know, I was right out of law school, and he had this quote that was like, whatever, 50, you know, 3 words long or 54 words long or 60 words long, whatever. So I put a little margin note, block quote, question mark. And we would give them back to him, and then he would comment on our comments, which was, you know, quite educational. And in this instance, to my question about should this be in a block quote, he responded, not if you want people to read it. And there's really, you know, a lot to be said for that. There are ways to entice people to read block quotes, and really the basic idea is is that you need to challenge the reader to read it by introducing the blog quote with a statement, and it basically tempts the reader into reading it by showing that the statement that introduces it actually is true. So you sort of, you tease the reader to read the blog quote. But, you know, most of the time, it's much more useful to figure out a way to shorten it or put it in your own words so as just avoid the blog quote altogether.
Some other sort of pet peeves that I have when I read other motions that are responsive to things I've filed are just, you know, over-formalization of those definitions and then, you know, writing numbers, you know, $30, $30, I don't think you need to do, write the number and then spell out the number. We can understand numbers. I think in a plan of organization, maybe that has a place. But, I think in normal motion writing, we don't need to do that. And also, you know, make sure you take a look at the local rules. The Seventh Circuit has very strict formatting rules, so you want to make sure that you comply with those. Our court has formatting rules, so you want to make sure that you're familiar with those. The judges do notice, and I think it just gives, more of a professional look to your final product when you've taken time to look at the rules that they've taken time to come up with and have a purpose. So that's sort of my two cents on
this. Laura, what tips do you have, or the panel, for catching typos? I mean, I do, it is so distracting to be reading along in a really good brief or a really good motion, and all of a sudden, bam, it hits you. I have, a pretty large Chapter 11 case, and they want me to rule in their favor all the time, of course, and so they think one way to do this is to cite the treatise that I work on, which is Ginsburg and Martin on bankruptcy, and the way that is supposed to be cited, since I'm the editor-in-chief, is, and I put this right in the front of the book in case you don't remember, Susan B. Kelly, editor, Ginsburg and Martin on bankruptcy. So they, of course, looked in the front of the book, and they're going to cite the treatise, and they cite Susan B. Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y. Well, that's not how I spell my name. And it's sort of, they sort of lost their extra credit for citing the treatise by spelling my name wrong.
Exactly.
Never use sick when you cite the treatise. Just, you know, if you find a, I'm sure there are no typos, but on the off chance that the publisher made a mistake, just correct that.
That's right.
And
that's,
I think,
right. Fix that, please.
I think
Peppers
people
is sort of an unusual spelling. I get pluralized with peppers. Alarming. There are several of me floating around out there. I'm peppers.
Judges' names are one thing. You just really, really have to make sure your staff knows, anybody who's touching this brief knows that you got to get the judge's name right. But I'm talking more about just the when you proof your own stuff, and I do it. I do it. When I proof my own stuff, I read what I want to see. Mm-hmm. I read what I think is there, and sometimes it's not there.
Well, Judge,
so
and I
what
think,
are some tips
well,
for?
I think, not to interrupt you, Judge, the biggest thing I think is helpful is finding the prickliest person in my office to read it. You know, I mean, I think that's the, you know, when I know they're going to give me a hard time, and, you know, I think that's the person that you want reading your stuff. But I think if you're self-checking, I mean, I think you've got to walk away from it for at least 10 minutes, yeah. Come back to it, print it out.
Yeah,
print
it out.
I learned
it's
those.
It's amazing what you
yeah.
find in written form versus
yeah.
reading
yeah.
it.
Yeah, there are
even
tricks. I mean, you can read the, you know, read the citations, sentences separate. You can read it backwards. But I've done all those tricks and still miss things, so I don't know. There's no
perfection. Well, you hire people who are detail people.
Right.
I know that I'm not a detail person, so I made sure that the three people in my office are. And I remember one time Doris, who was my former JA, said, "Oh, I've been correcting de-spelling for years." I said, "You have?" and so it's good to have somebody like that around who will do that for you. If you know yourself that you're not the sort of, I mean, you read for content and you read, you know, you read like that.
Yeah, I think the two biggest ones that have already been mentioned is definitely hard copy. Definitely hard copy proofing of everything, and give yourself a break. And I would say even more than 10 minutes. I know deadlines are always looming, but if you can give yourself a day, you will forget exactly what you had written enough mm-hmm. to read it then as to what's on the page. 10 minutes you might still,
mm-hmm. sure.
you know, remember.
Some of the billable hours really fast.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I mean. I know there's deadlines. So. Are we ready to?
Yeah, I think so. Take us away.
All right. So a few years ago, a presentation was given by me for illustrations of the principles and techniques described herein.
Said presentation was very well received by the members of the audience. It's important to note, though, that the presentation has since received modification and improvement, and what follows is presentation by me of said modified and improved material. So what did I just say?
Passive voice.
Not passive voice. My point is, and I had to write that down.
I've said over the years.
And I had to write that down in order to remember it. Why? Because that's not the way we talk. So why is it the way we write? And that's the question that I want to bring to you today. And if that was what you initially wrote, something like that is what you initially wrote, and you saw Judge Pepper reaction to it, it drives people nuts. So if that's your initial first draft, we got to work on that to make it better. And the point of writing a draft, whether it's a motion, an order, a brief, is to give yourself something to revise. Unlike a first-year law student who told me, I don't write drafts, I write final copy. No. except maybe Judge Easterbrook. But no one really writes that well in the first go-round. As you know from doing this, that writing is thinking and thinking is writing, and sometimes our thoughts are a little garbled in that first go-round, so we need that stuff on paper to revise it, to make it smooth and pretty and organized. So what you see on page 2 of your handout looks like a typed page with some handwriting on it. The internet tells me that that's a working draft of George Orwell's 1984. So as you can see, even George Orwell took a lot of time and crossed a lot of stuff out. And that's the kind of thing we need to do to revise. If we don't revise, we end up with the big block quote, I think it's still on page 2 of your handout, from Chase versus Culver. That is a 178-word single sentence. When I teach this in class, I have somebody read it out loud, and they take many, many breaths. And at some point, they don't know what they're reading, and the students don't even know what they're hearing. What this quote says is, "We made a mistake last time." That's all they're trying to say. But if we're not revising, these are the things we end up with. So when we talk about revising, we're really talking about learning how to write concisely, or at least edit for concision, because much of our first drafts contain language that, as I said before, sort of convoluted, sort of reflective of maybe our thinking at that point in time. And the reasons we tend to write like this to begin with is, and there are some of the answers there, is because at some point maybe you had a page requirement. You had a minimum page number you had to meet, so you learned to meet it whether you were done at page 5 or not. You had to go to page 6 in order to get credit, right? So you learn to make your words longer, say the same thing again, that kind of thing. We also tend to write more convoluted in a way to show how smart we are. And there is a Princeton professor who did a study of Stanford undergrads, and he found that indeed, students admitted to making their writing more fluffed up in order to appear smarter to the audience that they were writing to. As Professor Joseph Williams has said, and it's one of my favorite quotes, some writers plump up their prose to impress those who think that complicated sentences indicate deep thinking. And that is not true. We also tend to write that way because we emulate what we've read. We've all been through law school. We know the kind of not clear writing that we had to read in case books, and we tend to think, well, that must be how lawyers write, which maybe at one point in time it was. It's not what we're trying to do any longer. And finally, we might write that way because we don't understand what we're talking about yet. Either we're still working through it in our heads, or we think we've worked through it and we still don't get it. And that's how it turns out. And as Einstein says, if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. And our job as legal writers is to take those complex things and express them simply so the reader can get what we're saying and can get what we're saying with the least amount of mental work as possible. Because they're busy people. We're busy people. Does any of this matter? Yes, on page 3 of the handout, I have showed you a judge in Florida who denied a party's motion to extend the page limit of the brief took a snippet of the brief and edited it down for the lawyers. And you can kind of see that there. And it said, and says, in fact, references Brian Gardner's elements of legal style and says, follow this and you should have no trouble meeting the 25-page deadline. So that's not what you want your, you don't want anyone to be doing that to you. So a lot of what we've been talking about here is this idea of making things easier for the reader to understand. And as I said, they're busy, you're busy too. But the reader needs to be able to process stuff quickly and easily and clearly. And one of my colleagues at Arizona State University says a reader is like a juggler. A juggler and a reader can, and the balls of that juggler juggles are like the ideas that the reader is working with. And a good reader, a good juggler, can easily and successfully process or juggle, if you will, two or three balls at a time. That's manageable. But as soon as you add more balls for that juggler, the more concentration and effort the juggler is going to have to take to keep all those balls in the air. Likewise, it's more work the reader has to do to try to manage all that information. And at some point, if you've got four, five, six ideas that you're trying to juggle, the reader's going to drop one. And the consequence for you as a legal writer is, do you want the idea that drops to be the most important one you had to make? Do you want to take that chance, right? And secondly, your reader's going to be really not happy with you for making her work that hard to process that information. It's not that your reader isn't smart. They are. We are, right? It's just that's just too much to have to cognitively deal with. So cognitive load theory tells us that the reader can successfully process only a couple of ideas at a time. And there's two ideas of this that's important for what I'm going to say next. And one is called extraneous load. An extraneous load is anything that consumes our working memory without any positive impact on learning. So that is typos, format errors, all the too many citations, useless stuff, all that stuff your mind has to sort to actually get to the point. And we'll talk about how to reduce extraneous load. Intrinsic load is the stuff that, it's how hard your reader has to work in order to process the information. And we lawyers are really good at making very long and over-particularized sentences, which makes it harder for the reader to process, and we'll talk about ways to reduce intrinsic load by shortening your thoughts, making them more concise. So we won't have time to go through this entire presentation, so I'll hit some highlights here. So on page 4, I give you a large-scale revising suggestions. Making sure you have everything you need and it's all in the right order. And Laura mentioned, following court rules. It's a very simple thing, but it actually goes a long way. I ran into a student of mine yesterday who did a summer clerkship and had to file something with the court. She just followed whatever the court rules were. The judge had told her what a great job she did organizing her writing and how wonderful it looked, and she said, all I did was follow the rules in the book. And the judge said, well, that just goes to show you how few people actually do that. So one thing I think, if you are emailing or electronic filing your documents, be sure to check and double check that you are filing the most recent clean version of your document. Because we do electronic uploading of papers to grade in law school, and I've had students upload things that you might see on page 5 of the handout with the track changes there, with the comment bubbles there, an earlier version of something they were working on and not the final. It's easy to do. So make sure if you're electronic filing, your document's properly named, saved, it's clean, it's good. So that would reduce the extraneous load. Judge opens it up or the clerk opens it up, and it's just nice. Mm-hmm. It's right there.
And no red on the docket.
And then on page 5, also small scale revising with paragraphs and then with sentences and words. And that's where we start to work on reducing the intrinsic load. On page 6, there's a question about which sentence you like to read better. And there's two choices. people who read both these sentences easily and automatically say, well, the second one. The question, though, that is a little harder for some to answer is why. So why is the second one better? Some people say it's shorter. Yes, it's shorter. But if you really sit down and look at it, there are lots of things that were rearranged or taken out of the first one that made the second one shorter, more concise, active voice, moves along better. And those are the things that we're going to talk about. So on page 6, there's a list of things that you can do to make your sentences more concise. And then I go through each of those things, like omitting needless words. The thing here is to look for the words that you don't need, and sometimes if you're having a hard time figuring it out what it is you want to say, my suggestion is to just say it out loud and write down or type what you're saying. Chances are when you say it out loud, either to somebody else or just to yourself in your office, you're going to articulate it in a way that's far clearer than what you might have typed. So write down what you have said and then work with that instead. Let's see. So then also, I'll see on page 7, you want to vary your sentence lengths, but average, and this is just an estimate, about 20 words per sentence. It's a suggestion. On the one hand, too many short sentences back to back starts to read like the Dick and Jane books we started with. That's not any fun to read. Too many sentences that are too lengthy back to back, that increases that intrinsic load, too difficult to process. So you want to kind of vary. Short sentences are powerful. They're easy to remember. So if you want your reader, if you want the judge to remember something, put it in a short sentence. If you want to bury some unfavorable facts, not that, you know,
never.
Yeah. A long sentence, long complex sentence, right? It's still there, you're saying it, it's just sort of hidden, right? Also on page 7, keep subjects and verbs close together and at the start of the sentence. The way that we think and talk as English readers is we're anticipating some action, subject, verb, object. So give the reader that action. If you look on page 8, there's a lengthy paragraph there that starts with, if any partner becomes a bankrupt partner, da-da-da-da-da. See if you can locate the subject and verb and object. And I'll give you a second to do that. So when someone finds a subject, can you let me know what the subject is?
Partnership.
Okay, and what's the verb?
May buy.
May buy. And the object? May buy what?
Partnership.
Okay. Yep. So there you go. But look at how many words separate the subject from the verb. And if you underline, and here's the tip for looking for this, if you underline the first 7 words of your sentence, you ought to see your subject and your verb. And if you don't, you might want to rewrite. And if you underline the first 7 words of that sentence, all you get is, I think, the very first line. If any partner becomes a bankrupt partner, that's it. So all that information is important for the reader. It's going to be important for the reader. The suggestion is just to rewrite to give you the subject and the verb right off the bat. The partnership may buy a bankrupt partner's interest. Then, in a separate sentence, tell the reader when that can happen. Page 9, you want to prefer active voice over passive voice, but passive voice isn't always bad. We do use it, but use it consciously, purposefully. Okay? Passive voice is good when you don't know the actor or when you want to de-emphasize the actor or the real subject of the sentence. So looking for passive voice is looking for and circling all those to-be verbs. Is, was, are, were, have, had, had. All of those verbs followed by a verb that ends in ED, and you're going to find passive voice.
Lisa, do you have any suggestions for when you're drafting a fact section? Everything's in the past.
Yes, that you can't get away with.
Sure.
But there's past tense and there's passive voice.
Sure.
So you want to, the chair broke is past tense, but it's active voice.
Right.
The chair was broken is passive voice.
Sure. And what about the timeline, walking through the reader through, like, this happened on January 1, 1999, or...
I think you said, a nice thing that they're narratives, right?
Sure.
The facts section, at least for briefs, what we tell students with briefs, they're stories. These are people with stories.
Sure.
Or businesses with, but they have stories too, because they are people.
And I keep thinking that it's a good idea for lawyers to be readers. And if you want to read somebody who is able to condense a story, read somebody like Hemingway or Capote, because I have and I think, dang, I know that person and it's only one paragraph. How did you do that?
Right.
But there are certain writers who are very concise and effective and really communicate well, and so read all you can.
Yeah.
I think that confusion, though, between past tense and passive voice is very prevalent. And the easiest rule for me is, if a stranger to your writing can't tell who did this thing, it's passive. So it was decided, yeah. It was created, it was manufactured. I don't know who did that. And right. For my own self in writing, I'm uncomfortable saying it was decided because I feel like I'm deferring my own responsibility.
Right.
I decided it, and I ought to own it and take responsibility for it instead of saying this decision appeared out of the ether somewhere.
Right. And that's the other thing to look for is it was, there were, there was, those are like dead openings, if you will. That's going to be a lead-in to passive voice because there's, what if it was? What is there were? You know, there's ways to rewrite those sentences, and there are examples in here. I'll just kind of skip.
Inserted.
Did they work?
We're just laughing about mistakes were made.
Yes.
Yes. Deferral of all responsibility.
Yes, yes. That's a great example, right? No, we don't want to acknowledge. I'm sorry? When you want to bury the subject or the actor, so I mean, if you have a client who's maybe, I mean, you wouldn't in bankruptcy court, but let's say you're representing a defendant who is alleged to have assaulted somebody, and in fact did, you don't want to say in your fact section, the defendant assaulted the victim on this day, right?
His arm. You want to say the defendant's arm was broken.
Yeah.
Or the
plaintiff's arm was broken, or the victim, alleges an assault occurred on whatever. Yeah. So you want to bury that act. You want to bury the actor. You want to bury what happened. It takes the emphasis off of that.
But of course, your reader may say, "So who did it?"
Yep. And it's and not. Yeah. It's like sometimes can be a transparent technique, but it's something that's in the arsenal for writers to use.
It's also helpful if you don't know who did it.
And if you don't know who did it,
if
right?
If an event occurred and nobody knows who caused it, then an accident happened.
Accident happened, right. And then starting on page 10, I talk about words. I'll just hit a few things here that have already been said. Legalese, it. There are legal terms of art. You need legal terms of art, but you don't need legal ease. The here and after, the theretofores, et cetera, et cetera. So you want to get rid of your legal jargon. You want to use strong, precise verbs. So again, looking for the is, was, what, are, were, those ones, turning those into actual stronger verbs. The ION words are called nominalizations. Those used to be verbs that we've turned into nouns. Decision is one. The verb that's buried in there is to decide. So instead of Judge Pepper made a decision, Judge Pepper decided. Simplifying bloated phrases. This is where you want to look for your prepositions. Of is a big one. As, by. I would suggest doing a find for this, using computer to do find. The reason for that is if you look at the bottom of page 12, in that sentence, how many F's do you see?
Oh, yeah.
And try not to reread it twice. Read it once.
Tell me the one that says how many F's are not.
So how many F's are in that in there? Three.
Six.
Seven. Well, not counting the, let's not count the title. So I saw some more threes. So if you flip the page, the first three are easy to see. Judge Kelly, I'll bet you missed the three that are in the of's.
Yeah,
there are indeed six. So that's why I suggest doing the find for the prepositions, because we read right over those guys. And I don't want to take up any more time because I think we want to leave some for questions. Oh, page 13 and 14, kind of going along yours, parentheticals. You don't need to write a number and then give the Arabic number, right? Or use parentheticals only when there's a genuine chance your reader might be confused. The cartoon on page 14 says it all. Okay? Lawyers are really good at this. It makes reading really difficult. And it's all that extraneous load.
One thing I just want to put a pitch for is I think this is a great resource too, and actually contains a lot of the legal jargon and sort of calls it out. And I think it's just a really great resource to have in your office and take a look at when you've got 5 minutes. It's The Winning Brief by Brian Garner.
Yep.
So I recommend it. It's on Amazon. I love it. So yeah, I recommend that.
And I think I also had How to Write Good Legal Stuff by Eugene Volokh, and that's a great source. Also, lots of the list of the legalese type things, the bloated phrases that lawyers use a lot of.
And then if you do a search on Garner's website, he has scores, I think, of video clips ranging from well-known jurists to well-known authors. And really my favorite one is one by David Foster Wallace about what is introduced by Garner as genteelisms, and Wallace just goes off on the difference on using prior to instead of before in a really entertaining way. But there's a lot of there's a lot of sort of interesting things and good stuff if you really, you know, you find yourself interested in listening to what good writers and some of whom are judges think about this stuff.
Do we?
Any questions from the audience? Just a tip I just got. I went to the judges school in Boston last month, and I went to a session on writing opinions for judges. And it was supposed to be for brand new judges, but I'm like, hey, I could use some help with this too. And I think we all can. We all can use these refreshers. But anyway, one of the tips that I got was read your opinion out loud. If you think you're done with it, stop and read it out loud, and you will find those awkward sentences or those parts that are confusing or don't say what you think they mean. And I've been trying to do that. I mean, it doesn't work for misspellings. You'll probably still say the word right that you're seeing, but to just for the trying to get your style right and make your brief as persuasive as possible, maybe try that, reading it out loud. Okay. I want to thank our panel. It was a great presentation. Come on back in October. We're going to have the Pro Se Help Desk basics and basics for helping represent pro se people, dealing with pro se people. And we're going to have breakfast. Thank you to the Eastern District Bar Association. See you next month.
Also, one other little plug. We're having a Eastern District Bankruptcy Committee happy hour on Thursday at John Hawks Pub at 5 o'clock. It's great happy hour specials, and we're trying to get some interest in planning for some future bankruptcy CLEs with the Bar Association. So.
Excellent. John Hawks on Thursday night?
At 5 o'clock.
Yep. Excellent.
Great.